Hey everybody, one of the rare repeat guests on the Sad Truth today, I've got Matt Ridley back. How you doing, Matt?
God, I can't tell you how honored I am to be a repeat guest. That is great.
you still have to do a bit more work to be the only three-peat so far, which is Dave Rubin. And Michael Shermer will be coming on this Friday for a three-peat. So hopefully we can have you back soon so you could tie up those two other bastards.
Well, they're both great guys, but Michael's a good friend, so I won't try and topple him from his.
What percentage of the books behind you have you actually read?
I would say 90-something percent. There's definitely ones there that I didn't get more than a few pages in and then put them on the shelf saying I'm going to do it again. But but they only get to go on that shelf if I've read them, basically.
Oh, very nice.
In fact, each shelf relates to a book I've written. You know, these were the books I was consulting regularly while I was writing. It's not quite that neat, but if I took you over there and showed you, you would find a book called, you know, Genomics, another shelf called Innovation, another shelf called Rational Optimism.
Another shelf called the God Sad Infinite Wisdom shelf, correct?
It's nothing quite that brilliant, I'm afraid. The quality doesn't get that.
Okay, so let me just...
How many books have you written, Gerd?
This is going to be the one that I have forthcoming, The Parasitic Mind, which will be out in October. It will be my fourth one. But one of them is an edited book. So it's three authored books and one edited book. So I'm way behind you.
Yeah, I was having an argument with Shermer about who's written more books. And he was saying we must be about the same. But he writes about one every 2 years. And he's a little bit older than me, so I don't believe that. But anyway.
Well, I'm in neither of your leagues. I'm just a little peasant.
No, you're not far behind.
Okay, so I thought I would just remind people who you are. You are a member of the House of Lords in the British Parliament. You're also now you call yourself a journalist, but you have bona fide scientific credentials. You have a PhD in zoology. You've written a whole bunch of great books. Let me just mention a few, which I've already mentioned in the previous case. I'll just mention one or two. Nature via Nurture. I love that expression. The Rational Optimist, The Evolution of Everything, How Ideas Emerge, and then your current book, How Innovation Works, which we'll spend most of our time talking about. So one of the challenges in preparing for such a talk, especially for someone who's been on so many podcasts and shows, is to try to think of questions that hopefully others have not asked you. So maybe at the end of the show, you'll tell me what my grade is, whether I was able to get an A or whether I'm in the F zone. So hold that judgment till later. So first, maybe just give us the big elevator story of what the book is about.
The book is called How Innovation Works, and I'm actually very pleased with it. It's come together well, and I think it makes a great read, because I've been dancing around the topic of innovation in previous books, and Rational Optimist, Evolution of Everything is a lot about innovation. But I've never actually sat down and said, you know, here is this mysterious process called innovation that happens to us and not to rabbits or rocks. That is absolutely central to the story of the last 200 years in particular, and the last 10 years and the next 10 years too. And it's behind not just our technology, but our culture and our society, etc. It's all subject to innovation. And yet, as I say, it's a mysterious process. We don't fully understand why it happens, when and where it does. We don't seem to be able to turn it on or turn it off at will. Well, we can turn it off, but we're not very good at turning it on. And so what is it? You know, why does it happen, and where does it happen, and who does it happen with? And in the end, I decided the way to work out the answer to this question was to tell a bunch of stories. So I start out by telling the story of the steam engine. I eventually end up telling the story of the search engine. And in between, I tell the story of vaccines, and I tell the story of vaping. And I tell 20 or 30 stories, some long, some short, about how innovations came into the world, who was involved. Quite often, there are interesting biographical details about the people who were closely involved. And then I try and draw out some lessons as to what these stories teach us. And they are things like it's more gradual and collective than we think. It depends on a huge amount of trial and error. It's often serendipitous. That is to say, it changes direction. You know, you set out to discover one thing and invent one thing, and you invent something else, and so on and so forth. So I pull out all these interesting features of innovation, and I think I've put together as good a shot as I can to make this mysterious process less mysterious.
Now, you started with saying that you're using a storytelling style, narrative style to tell your story. Now, we're both evolutionists, and so we appreciate the evolutionary roots of storytelling. For example, gossip has an evolutionary root because it serves as a means by which we transfer evolutionary relevant information to one another. So when you were deciding to use that style versus a drier style, let's call it that, were you cognizant of the fact that it would likely be more persuasive because our brains are prepared to listen to stories?
Yeah, but I was being even more basic than that, which was I was thinking, what do I like to read?
Okay.
I like to read stories. And so, you know, if a really good nonfiction book making a solid argument for 250 pages lands on my desk, I think, great, I'm going to enjoy this. But I don't quite enjoy it as much as I would if it had a sort of beginning, middle, and end narrative story. So biography or history, you know, if I'm reading a book for pleasure as opposed to work, it's nearly always a book with a story. It might be a novel, or it might be a biography, or it might be a history of something. What happened next? You know, that's right. And as you say, that's deep inside our psyche somewhere. So it's a bit late in my life to suddenly realize that actually people like stories and one should write stories in one's books. But I've got there eventually.
So where do you fall on the – so as I'm sure you know, but I might mention it very briefly for the viewers who don't know, there's a distinction between an adaptation, something that evolved because it procures survival or mating advantage, or an exaptation, a byproduct of evolution. The color of our skeletal system is not due to an adaptive mechanism. It's a byproduct of other, you know, it's a path-dependent mechanism. So literature, since we're talking about storytelling, there are some folks who tell us, oh, well, literature is an adaptation. Here are the reasons. Whereas I think most folks would say that it is an exaptation. It is a byproduct of our big brains that need to be nourished and entertained. Where do you follow on that dichotomy?
Yeah, I think exaptation is a good way of looking at it. Because I think the word was coined by Stephen Jay Gould, wasn't it?
I think so.
And I find it a very useful phrase, actually, because an awful lot of the time, when you look at evolutionary progression, you find that something was invented for one purpose and then it got readapted to another purpose. So I can't remember, you know, gill arches turn into jawbones or something. I may have got that wrong, but, there's all right. These examples. Evolution is very good at repurposing things to different uses. And that is, of course, extremely true of technology, too. And it's true of some of these innovations that happen. So I think, you know, the interest in people and who they are and where they came from and what happens next is deep inside us. And storytellers are people who are exploiting that, are riding on that, and are sort of, So maybe I don't think it's an acceptation. Maybe I think it's an adaptation. I don't know. You've caught me there. I don't really know how to.
Okay, I'm getting close to that A grade. So continuing with the evolutionary theme, to what extent is your analysis of innovations across many different domains, you know, human domains, whether it be in scientific innovation or product innovation, technological innovation, how much do you use evolutionary thinking in your analysis?
I use evolutionary thinking a lot. I think it is evolutionary thinking is absolutely central to this, because what we're seeing, you see descent with modification in what's happening? Oh, I'm being telephoned by someone. Sorry,
no worries.
That shouldn't happen. In technologies and the stories of them and the patterns of them, you see descent with modification. You know, you see things changing gradually from one to another. So the first motor cars look like the outcome of a mating between a steam locomotive and a horse carriage around the back of a bicycle shed, roughly speaking. So these patterns of descent with modification are really interesting and really important. Why do people leave messages?
Focus.
Sorry. I need to somehow turn that off, but yeah. I don't know how to. You get descent with modification, you get adaptation, you get competition for survival, you get the struggle for existence, you get trial and error, which is a version of natural selection, if you like. These are all features of evolutionary systems. I'm going to just make sure my phone doesn't interrupt us again. There we go. And I think they are characteristic of technological evolution as well as biological evolution. And it's not an analogy. It's a homology. It's the same process.
Explain those two words because they're very important. I often lecture about them to my students. So for those of our viewers who don't know the difference between an analogous and a homologous trait, take it away, Matt.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm not very good at defining things, but the way I see it is that I'm not here saying this is a metaphor,
right?
For how innovation works. This is actually how it works. There is variation followed by selection. That is the definition of an evolutionary system. Now, the variation may not be completely random because people may be setting out to achieve some change. But as long as there's a degree of randomness in there, as long as there's some mess around it, then you will get enough variation for selection to go to work. And if you look at, just take a very simple innovation, like a new word. Let's say the word COVID, which has entered the language in the last few weeks. That's an innovation, right? It's a new word that we've evolved, that we've started to use. It has undergone an evolutionary phenomenon already. It started out as the coronavirus that is causing COVID-19. And that's too long. If we're going to use a word a lot, we need to shorten it. And so shorter versions have been displacing longer versions. So we've dropped the 19, we've dropped coronavirus. We're now talking about the COVID virus or COVID. I don't know which way you pronounce it yet. It's a very nice, if words are used a lot, they get shorter. And they do this by an evolutionary change. So that's an innovation. Right. And it's an innovation that evolves. And the same is true of my iPhone or my laptop or whatever. These are devices that have survived selection to get to where they are. I tell the story in the book I've told this story about the philosopher Alain, who said, he was a Frenchman called Émile Chartier, but he said, if you think of a boat that is beautifully designed, it is actually copied from a previous boat. The boatmaker didn't start from scratch. He copied this design from another boat. He may have changed it a bit, but he took some basic features and so on back to the first boat. And a badly made boat will end up on the bottom after several voyages, and a good boat won't. So it's the good boats that survive. So he's saying, look, this is exactly a Darwinian process. Right. And the same is true when you think about it for an aeroplane. You think of an aeroplane as being designed by a clever person. But actually, it's not. The designer took the idea from a previous design, which he adapted a little bit, and he took it from a previous design, and so on, all the way back to the Wright brothers.
I mean, Newton said, I think, standing on the shoulders of giants or something to that effect. So I think that's exactly what you're saying. Now, I've read some papers in the management literature that argue that product innovation follows, to stay on the evolutionary theme, follows a Lamarckian process. Are you familiar with that argument? And if so, can you maybe discuss it? Because of course, Lamarck sort of became the guy that you don't want to speak about because he got it wrong, and then Charles Darwin corrected him. Now we see with some epigenetic research that maybe he was sort of right on some things where you can retain some trauma that your grandparents had that is passed on not through genetic. For example, the Dutch famine studies. So, how is product innovation a Lamarckian process?
Well, Lamarckism means the inheritance of an acquired characteristic. So I break my leg, my children have broken legs. They're born with broken legs. I mean, obviously, that's not true. And in fact, the great sort of demolition of Lamarck was when August Weismann literally cut off the tails of mice before they bred and then bred them and said, look, they've still got tails, you know, so it's not working. You know,
or Jewish kids should be born already circumcised.
I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, it's a good point. It's even closer to the action, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's basically wrong on a biological level. And the reason it's wrong is because you're not descended from your parents' body. You're
You froze a bit.
These few cells.
Yeah, okay, go on.
I froze a bit, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The reason that Lamarckism is wrong in biology is because you're not descended from your parents' bodies. You're descended from your parents' germlines, from these few cells inside your parents that were going to become sperm and egg. And there isn't such a distinction in technology. When you copy a boat to make another boat, you don't take the gonads of the boat and breed from them. So in that sense, Lamarck can be right. If during the course of life, that boat has an adaptation made to it, it has a new device added to it, which works well, then that can be copied in its offspring. So yes, there is an element. Lamarck does get a look in technological evolution. It's true. But all the same, that doesn't stop it being a Darwinian process of selection.
Right.
The key Darwin insight is that if you get variation, then some varieties will survive better than others. And that seems to me to be, you need to keep hold of that in understanding technology.
I mean, I think your current book is speaking to something that I think we might have discussed the last time you were on the show, the idea of universal Darwinism, the notion that the Darwinian process that is so, is great for explaining the evolution of species can be applied to so many other areas of life. Evolutionary epistemology, how knowledge gets selected, right? That itself is an evolutionary process, right? So Donald Campbell, many years ago, developed the field of evolutionary epistemology. So I think what's wonderful about the work you're doing, and it's something that I constantly fight for in academia, if not in the public sphere, is that the insights of Darwin are not limited to simply explaining the mating behavior of the salamander. It is extraordinarily
Correct.
More powerful than that, right?
Correct. And I mean, I borrowed this phrase from Richard Webb, but I think it's quite a useful way of thinking about it. Darwin came up with the special theory of evolution, just like Einstein came up with a special theory of relativity. But there's a general theory of evolution too, which is that systems with variation and selection will result in increased complexity and spontaneous order. And I would place the first real exposition of that a little too neatly, exactly 100 years before Darwin, 1759, Adam Smith writes the book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he is saying, effectively, I think the reason that people have ethical standards and moral ways of looking at the world is not because they're taught top down by priests, but because they through trial and error, bottom up, they work out in their lives what works and what doesn't, what gets you into trouble and what doesn't. And he's therefore looking at a sort of bottom-up spontaneous order explanation of morality, which he later applies to the economic system. So he's looking at evolution throughout society, whereas Darwin is looking at it specifically in biological systems. And I would argue that we are still too creationist about the human world. We're no longer so creationist about the biological world, ironically. So we don't think when we see a complex body structure of a creature that that must imply a designer. But when we see a complex pattern in human society, like how a city feeds itself, to borrow an example from Frederick Bastiat, then we jump to the conclusion that somebody must be in charge of that. And we make this mistake every 4 years at the ballot box by saying what we need is someone brilliant to run the country. when actually the country mostly runs itself.
Well, there's something related to what you're saying. It's not, this is not my term. I can't remember the authors who coined it, but it's called the human reticence effect, which, let me sort of paraphrase it in my colorful way. If you take 1,999,999 species and use evolution to explain their morphological traits and behavioral patterns, it's science. It's perfectly okay. But there is that one species, the 2 millionth species called humans, that how dare you, sir, use the exact same evolutionary thinking, the exact same epistemology, the exact same methodology, the exact same theoretical framework. No, it's pseudoscience. And I get a lot of imbeciles on Twitter, some of whom are fellow academics, who succumb to this bias, right? I mean, you know, if I show them exactly the same arguments in explaining the behavior of the salamander, well, it just feels sciency. But when you apply it to the human mind, well, that's just pseudoscience gibberish.
That you're absolutely right, and this is something I've wrestled with in previous books, and to me, it is the most extraordinary thing about the humanities is that they can sail around erecting hypotheses about human behavior without ever referencing the fact that other animals might have a similar pattern, that men are different from women and as males are different from females in every other species, for example. You and I know Martin Daly and Wilson did this superb piece of data showing that young men commit more crimes in all societies, even very peaceful ones where young men don't commit very many crimes. The pattern is that young men commit more crimes than old men, and they commit more crimes than young women. Sociologists go to great lengths to explain why this is the result of young men being taught violence or something like that. And they never think of looking at other animal species and looking at the fact that violence is an attribute of young males in pretty well all mammals around the time when they acquire mates. Right. I mean, it's sort of something that happens. Doesn't make it insoluble, you know, quite the reverse. You can make societies very peaceful as long as, you know, for example, getting rid of polygamy was probably a very important way to pacify society because it meant that there were fewer unmated males left over who were desperate.
Right. Well, incidentally, I mean, you know this, but some of our viewers may not know, parental investment theory, the brilliant theory that explains patterns of sexual dimorphism across sexually reproducing species, actually goes further than what you said, because it can look at sex role reversal species where it is the females, where it is the males who bear the greater minimal parental obligatory investment, and then all of the sex differences are perfectly reversed, right? The females are more violent. The females have more testosterone. The females build harems. So, I mean, to all the folks who say, oh, but evolutionary theorizing is unfalsifiable, the exact opposite is actually true.
Because that's really nice because I started my career as an undergraduate going to the Arctic and studying a bird called the red phalarope, which has exactly this pattern. It has large, colorful, aggressive females which compete over small, dull males who sit on the eggs and bring up the young. Now, how that came about in that species was one of the questions I was trying to answer because it's an unusual pattern. But there are a number of bird species that show this pattern. And you're absolutely right. It shows that if one parent is spending more time looking after kids, that parent becomes a scarce resource that the other sex competes for, basically.
Right. Let's continue with the innovation discussion and linking it to Darwinian theory. Are you familiar with Dean Symington's work? Do you know who that is? Does that ring a bell?
I know his name, but I'm not sure I'm familiar with his work.
So then maybe you won't be able to answer this question, but maybe we can spitball it together. He wrote a book, which I have somewhere here in my personal library. I haven't read it fully, but certainly perused through it diagonally, where he looks at creativity as a Darwinian process. So basically he's arguing, right? We come up with these ideas. Sometimes these ideas are random. They get selected if they're good. So I think there is a nice marriage between his argument applying specifically to the creative process. Now, obviously, innovation has an element of creativity. So my feeling is that there is a way to maybe link his work with yours, but I guess you're not familiar with it, so you can't comment too much about
it. I think that sounds really interesting, and I think you're right. And but the way I would put it might be a little bit different, because I'm trying to get away a little bit from the idea that there's some special source. There's a sort of quantum mechanics thing called creativity that some people have and other people don't, because I just don't think that's true. I think if you look at great innovators, the lesson they teach is one that we can all learn, you know, that we could all do this if we would just work hard enough, do a lot of trial and error, be open to learning from our mistakes, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so it's not about some extraordinary flame of genius that you possess inside you. So that's why I kind of shy away from the word creativity. But I suspect where he's right and where it might link with my thinking is that the really creative people tried lots of things. And if we're in trying lots of things, they rejected the things that didn't work, and they kept trying new ones until they found ways that did work. And that sounds pretty basic, and it sounds kind of not very clever, but actually it's a surprisingly important part of these clever people. You know, my classic example of this is Thomas Edison, who you know, made innovation into a product. He made it something that he could build a factory, and he would produce innovations in this factory. And he employed teams of people, and he set them on the tasks, and he told them to try and try again. Try this, try that, try everything, until you came up with the result. So in coming up with the filament for an incandescent light bulb, which he didn't claim to be the original inventor of, but he was one of 21 people who'd had roughly the same idea around the same time. That's another weird feature of innovation, is you get these simultaneous waves of it. In coming up with the right material for the filament of the light bulb, he tried 5,000 different plants until he could find a fiber that was just right. And he ended up with Japanese bamboo. And this was a fiber that when you put an electric current through it, so it glowed, it lasted for a long time, lasted for many hours. It didn't burn out quickly, and it gave a good repeatable light, as it were, every time you switched it on. So his genius there was to just keep looking and looking and looking and not be satisfied with, I don't know, Chinese bamboo or whatever it was that was second best, you know, and just keep going until you get the really best. So I think that is sort of what Dean Symington may be saying.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned about, you know, repeat failures, trial and error, you fail and then eventually you succeed, which brings me to actually a point that I've previously made in a different context, but I think it really is relevant to what you're discussing. So you probably have heard of this fundamental attribution error. You know, you attribute successes internally. I did well on the exam because I'm smart. And you attribute successes, failures externally. I did poorly on the exam because Dr. Ridley is an idiot, and he gave too hard of an exam, right? And so this attributional style is one that, regrettably, most healthy people succumb to, because actually the only people who don't succumb to this bias are clinically depressed people, right? Where they have, if you like, a more realistic attributional style, which, by the way,
leads... They don't even credit themselves with their own success.
Right. And so, which of course leads to the chicken and egg question. Did they start off with a realistic attribution style, which makes them more prone to depression? Or is it the depression that made them more? And we don't know exactly the answer to this. But my point of how I'm going to link this to your work. So a central feature, for example, of being a eventually successful entrepreneur is to internalize the relevant parts of your failures, right? So I can listen to the... I can think back of the sets of decisions that I've made and at least have the humility to say, you know, in retrospect, I did wrongly read the market and there wasn't a demand for this product. Whereas some entrepreneurs who fail, some of whom are in my family, hopefully they won't watch the show, are unbelievably inept at attributing failures internally. Therefore, this process of trial and error and learning from your failures can't happen because there is no feedback loop. Because whenever I fail, it's because the customers are idiots, not because I did something wrong.
Right.
Do you think at all about those types of things in discussing how the trajectory of innovations?
Well, that's really interesting because, you know, you're the kind of person we're talking about is often not a humble person, right, and is not liable to go around saying, fault, you know, I should have got done better. And yet they do learn from failure. And you know, they pick that, they have, of course, this amazing ability to pick themselves off the floor and try again. And I mean, I tell the story of Amazon in my book, which is a very successful company, but it came about as a result of a string of failures. And I'm not dissing it here. Jeff Bezos says the same thing. You know, they made a bunch of really stupid mistakes along the way. They invested in the wrong things. They bought the wrong dot-coms. They tried to do the wrong products. You know, again and again, they got things wrong. But in the end, they got it right. And Bezos says that's because we were swinging and missing. And if you swing enough, you'll eventually swing and hit.
Right.
I believe that's a baseball metaphor, but I'm not quite sure.
Right.
And
could be cricket. Could be cricket.
Yeah, we don't use the word swing quite the same way in cricket. I don't know why, but anyway, it's the same point. Yeah. It's a very nice point you've made, which I hadn't thought through probably, that being the kind of being pig-headed is useful up to a certain point, and saying, no, I know I'm right, I can do this. But being pig-headed to the point where you say, it's just the customers are stupid, they won't buy my product, and not being able to say, you know what, I ought to try again because the customer's always right. You know, that would be the way a genius entrepreneur would work.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish your point.
No. I mean, it's the learning from others as well that's important here, because I mean, there's a beautiful cautionary tale in the story of flight, of two attempts to get airplanes off the ground that came to fruition at exactly the same time, just 10 days apart in December 1903. And one of them was had a huge amount of government funding, and it had a brilliant man in charge, and he kept everything secret because he knew his ideas were so good he didn't want other people stealing them. And he built the whole thing at once. You know, he didn't test the different elements in separately. And it was a total flop. He was called Samuel Langley, and in front of a huge crowd, he launches his airplane, and it trickles off the top of a houseboat in the Potomac and crashes straight into the river, and the pilot has to swim to the shore. 10 days later, off an island off North Carolina, two bicycle mechanics from Ohio did something very different, which is that after 4 years of experiments with different gliders, different shapes of wing, different devices for steering and turning things in the air, different wind tunnel experiments behind them, different conversations with people who'd studied birds, different conversations with people who'd tried to build gliders, you know, they'd just drawn on every piece of knowledge they could. And they constantly made mistakes. One summer they was completely ruined because they'd been given this information by this genius glider designer about the ratio between the height of the wing and the width of the wing, you know, for the curved wing to get the lift. And he'd given them a dud advice, and their ratio was all wrong, and the thing kept crashing. You know, they were on the right track. And, of course, nobody believed them because they were just a couple of bicycle mechanics from Ohio.
That's the Wright brothers?
For about 5 years. That's the Wright brothers.
Right, okay, right. So you mentioned...
Wilbur and Orville Wright.
You mentioned flight. And I think I saw you in one of your recent podcasts as I was preparing for our chat, where you were talking about... I mean, you didn't use this term, but the rate of innovation, so this is my term, across industries will vary. Now, I want to link it to evolutionary thinking again. So if I think about, say, the selection of a gene to tolerate or synthesize, process lactose, that's going to be something that is selected for much more quickly than the fact that we now have a fixed trait of 10 fingers, right? So the rate at which a trait gets selected will vary depending on a whole bunch of factors. So now linking it to innovation across industries, are there any metrics that can help us, you know, predict why in industry A, the trajectory of innovation will be very quick. Technology, computers, where I think in one of the podcasts you said, I would not be using today a computer from 1969, but I'm still flying a jet that was from 1969. I think it was when you went to the Hoover Institution, or you were chatting with the guy from the Hoover Institution, you said that. So what might explain why the rate of innovation varies across industries?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. I don't have a full answer. I mean, one answer, which we can see very clearly today, is that government regulation bears down on some industries and makes it difficult to innovate in them. And Peter Thiel likes to make this point that, you know, we wanted flying cars and we got 140 characters because what we did was we made regulation extremely permissive in the digital sphere. You don't need anyone's permission to go out and invent a new software program. You don't have to get a license off a government agency. You don't need to spend a fortune applying for it. You just do it. So we've made it permissionless, largely, and that was actually quite an explicit piece of legislation that did that in the US. It was all the legislation in the late 1990s under the Clinton administration. Whereas if you want to invent a new drug or a new vaccine or a new medical device, it takes years to get it approved from the regulatory authorities, and you have to spend a fortune doing it. So we've actually made the regulations bear down much harder on innovation in atoms than in bits. Right. That's what Peter Thiel.
That's a good way of putting it. I like that.
And we've done so particularly severely in certain industries. So consider nuclear power. It's been unable to innovate for several decades now. And the reason is because we have such stringent regulations about how you design a nuclear power station, which specify in enormous detail in advance exactly where each nut and bolt will go before you get your license to build it. And it takes hundreds of millions of dollars to get the license. So there's no way you can change your mind halfway through. You can't learn. You can't risk trying a new design. Right. It's just not. You know, because the whole point of the new design is you don't know whether it's going to work, so you'd like to be able to sort of alter it as you go along. So nuclear power is cut off from the process that allows innovation to happen. Otherwise, it would have become much more efficient, much safer, and much cheaper by now, I suspect. No, there's a good reason for that, which is that we don't want too much trial and error in the nuclear industry, because that could be quite disastrous. And much the same with drug development and vaccines and so on. So that is an issue. But I don't think that fully explains why our innovations in transport have dried up so dramatically in recent decades. Because if you go back to the 1950s, they've had a bonanza of transportation innovations in the previous 50 years. You know, they've got the first cars, the first airplanes, the first jets, the first helicopters, the first space travel, the first missiles. You know, it's just a non-stop series of incredible changes. And they're expecting it to continue. They're expecting. So I've got a cartoon, which I like to show, of a mailman in the year 2020, according to people in the year 1958. Okay. This is a cartoon drawn in 1958, when they thought that by now the postman would be delivering letters, old-fashioned letters, but he would be doing so with a rocket strapped to his back. Okay. So they thought the future was all about transport innovations. In fact, it just dried up.
Right.
You know, as I said, we're flying around in 747s, which entered service in 1969. Our cars have more cup holders, yeah, and they're safer, but much safer. But they don't. They can go 70 or 80 miles an hour, but not much more. In fact, most of the time they go less because of traffic congestion and so on. So they didn't see the communications innovation coming because they hadn't had that much of it in the first half of the 20th century. But they did expect the transportation changes, which then didn't happen. And I think that's more about hitting diminishing returns, hitting a brick wall of some kind, of a physical kind, than it is about government regulation.
Right.
You know, I don't think we've stifled innovation in flying cars over the last 50 years. I just think they're not a practical proposition.
I have another possible cause of why some industries innovate less than others, and I'm going to go to my ecosystem, which is the university. I often joke, but perhaps not really joke, that universities is the place where you go, where innovations go to die. Now, the reason for that is because of bureaucratic inertia, where there's this really ugly monster called the bureaucracy that just exists to perpetuate angst on otherwise people who are very desirous to innovate. So let me give you one example, which kind of links back to your point about safety, that in some industries, because you need greater oversight, because if you get it wrong, it's unsafe. Okay, so let's build on that example. So in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the golden era of psychology, you could psychologically harm people to no ends, but since it was for the advance of our understanding of the human condition, it didn't matter. So the Milgram experiment and so on, and all the false feedback experiments. So I bring you into the lab, I give you some terrible false feedback. Oh, Matt, look, you just scored in the lowest one percentile in IQ. Okay, let's now do step two. Then later I even tell you, don't worry, it wasn't a true test, but the reality is I have injured your sense of self. You don't know anymore if I was telling the truth or not. So as a response to that, quote, golden era, we then developed the institutional review boards, the ethical boards that seek to oversee that, right? And of course, that makes sense. But now the pendulum has swung so far to the other side, so that if I ask you, what's your name? I might be offending you. What's your gender? Well, I didn't list 873 genders. Well, what's your ethnicity? But you don't have the right because you're hurting me. What's your income? But you can't ask that. So that even the most banal, innocuous research has to go through 13,000 years of oversight because, you know, someone's feelings might be hurt or they might have anxiety. So we've swung the other way. So now one of the most stressful parts in conducting research becomes just clearing the institutional review board, right? And well, that puts a hindrance on innovation, because if I'm spending 6 months going back and forth with the ethical board, it's hindering my innovation. So do you at all?
Absolutely.
Right. So in your book, do you look at whether universities are facilitators of innovation or hinderers of innovations, if I could say that, or you don't really look at that?
I don't go into it in great detail, partly because my focus is on innovation, not invention. And by that, I tend to mean the downstream stuff. And most of that is not necessarily happening in universities. And one of the things I'm trying to get across is that there is a distinction between invention and innovation, between coming up with a prototype and developing it and making it practical and affordable and available. To a large extent, universities are in the sort of the other process, the process of coming up with the original ideas. But of course, there is a relationship between invention and innovation. You know, they are part of the same ecosystem. And it is a general idea that universities are the places where the ideas are found. They are then taken out and applied, and we get technologies as a result. The trouble is that's largely a myth. That does sometimes happen. There is spin out from university ideas. But just as often, somebody goes out in the world of technology and tinkers with it and comes up with a new device, and then comes into the university and says, can you help me explain what's going on in my new device? I mean, just to take a big example, the steam engine led to the science of thermodynamics. The dye industry led to the science of chemistry. So it's just as often the other way around. And in fact, I like to tell the story in the book of the development of CRISPR-Cas9, the precise genome editing technology that has come available. It looks like a pure university idea that is now being applied in industry. MIT and Berkeley are fighting over the rights to who should have the patents, for example. But when you look at it closely, you find that actually they got it from the yogurt industry. The yogurt industry had a problem with bacteria getting sick with viruses. They needed to understand bacterial resistance to viral attacks. And one of the ideas they had picked up from a university guy, admittedly, although he was funded partly by the salt industry, was that there are these weird sequences in bacteria that are part of their immune system, which home in on very precise sequences of viruses. So So the linear model, where you start with a university and you end up with a business, ain't the way the world actually works. It often works the other way. Sometimes it does work that way. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's a myth to think it always goes that way. But what I'm recognizing in what you're saying is whether the university itself can be an innovative place in terms of its own practices. And that feels like one of those organizations that has a real problem in this respect. Yeah. Government is another. I mean, you know, it's no accident that our governmental systems are 200 years old in the way they operate. And, you know, when people say, well, we must put government in charge of innovation, you say, well, how come whenever there is an innovation, like, you know, using the telephone for the first time or using, you know, video conferencing for the first time, it's always invented in the private sector and the government adopts it and uses it rather than the other way around. You know, name me one sort of practical consumer electronic thing that was first practiced within government and then came out. Well, maybe you could say the internet was invented in DARPA, but it had to go through a huge amount of private development as well. So I do think that what you're describing in universities is a real problem and is one of the reasons why people like me aren't that interested in what's going on in universities these days, because we're not seeing the sort of innovative ferment of ideas and new ways of doing things that we would like to be seeing.
And I suspect, so here I'm speculating in my link to you, to your innovation concepts, but I think there's a link. So oftentimes I'm asked, are your evolutionary ideas, when you apply them to consumer behavior, to marketing, to economics, are they as accepted in industry as they are with academics? Well, first, the question is a bit more complicated than that, because if my academic colleagues are in the natural sciences, then they accept it. If they're in the social sciences, they accept it less, precisely because of biophobia, right? They're afraid of using biological principles to explain human behavior. But the dichotomy between industry and academia is really interesting, because when I give a talk in front of a bunch of high-powered executives about how to apply evolutionary thinking in advertising design, then people just say, oh, that makes perfect sense. Because they don't care. They're not vested in their own paradigm that they think is somehow contrary to what I'm saying. They just care about, does it work? Does using an evolutionary lens afford me the opportunity to create more effective persuasion strategies in advertising? If yes, then this guy is someone that I need to listen to. In academia, you're always listening to someone, regrettably, through the prism of your ideological commitment. So if Gad Saad's position is one that is contrary to the 30 years that I've already vested in my career, then he is a heretic who must be burned. So I think that's another reason why maybe things move more quickly in industry than in academia, because you're less likely to be parasitized by ideological commitment in industry. I just want to make money and make something that works in industry. I want to protect my fiefdom of ideology in academia. Does that make sense?
It does indeed, although I think you're perhaps overestimating the openness to new ideas of industry, because quite a lot of big industries in particular end up being taken by surprise by new technologies. But the demise of Kodak and the near demise of Nokia in my book, you know, Nokia is the biggest mobile phone company in the world in the 1990s, and it's scooped the pool. It's spending more on research and development than all the rest of the industry put together. It ought to be unassailable in its lead in this new world. In fact, what happens is that it's become so big and dominant in voice telephony that it doesn't want to disturb its monopoly by going down the data route. And so it ends up neglecting to develop the ability to handle data, and it ends up having its lunch eaten by Apple, basically. Big companies do become anti-innovative because they are vested in their own technologies. It may be not be an ideological investment in quite the same way, but it is nonetheless a problem. But just what you describe in academia reminds me of a very nice point, because I'm often very interested in the idea that, if you ask people about the world, they often, there are things that they make mistakes about what the world is like that a monkey wouldn't make. In other words, they're worse than random at some of this stuff. And Josh Billings, I think it was, who was some kind of 19th century American sage, said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that ain't so.
Very nice. Beautiful. Do you at all in your book look at characteristics of innovators? So now at the individual level, is there, I understand you said that there's no magic recipe and so on, but I mean, surely in the same way that two people who are born start off with different proclivity to become NBA stars, is there something, a personality trait, an environmental that is more likely to stack the deck for Thomas Edison being the entrepreneur that he became versus Joe Blow who didn't? Do you look at that at all?
I look at it a bit, and I look at it perhaps rather disappointingly by saying, I'm not sure there is anything very, at least not as much as you would expect, because you know there's a huge cottage industry in this kind of thing, isn't there? You know, looking for the kinds of personalities. And so I tell the story of Gordon Moore in my book. Do you know who Gordon Moore is? He's the guy who invented Moore's law, which is the improvement in computing over time.
Right.
And he's an incredibly important person in the story of Silicon Valley. He's there at the development of the first integrated circuits. He's there for he's one of the traitorous eight who left Fairchild Semiconductor to go and, I might have got that wrong, but anyway, you know, all the or maybe they set up for. Anyway, you know, he's the chief executive of what's the big chip making company? You know, anyway, you know the name very well, but anyway, so he's a central figure in the story of Silicon Valley. So he ought to be an immigrant, unreasonable, bad tempered, forceful, restless. He's none of these things. He's living 10 miles from where he was born. He happened to be born next to Silicon Valley, so that was lucky. He's never lived anywhere else. Okay. He's preternaturally nice and patient. He's never been able to fire anyone. You know, he's still alive, by the way, so you've got to be nice about him here. He loves fishing. He's very patient, you know. He's a nice guy. He's married to his childhood sweetheart, you know. Okay, he's all wrong. You know, he's not Steve Jobs,
right?
Or whatever. And yet he's in a very important figure. So my argument is that your personality might not matter that much. Being in the right place at the right time and being open to new ideas is probably important. There is a feature of Silicon Valley which Gordon Moore would never have indulged in, which Steve Jobs did indulge in quite a lot, and which has got a lot of people into trouble, but has also been quite successful, and was also something Thomas Edison did, and that's called fake it till you make it, which is when you announce that you're going to produce a certain product before you know that it's possible to produce it. And Steve Jobs and Thomas Edison were both apt to do that, to the horror of their team, you know. On March the 31st next year, we will produce a device that does X, Y, Z. What? We're not even halfway there yet. How can you announce that?
Deceptive signaling is certainly part of the evolved strategies that animals of all sorts have evolved, right?
Well, it results when it doesn't work in a concept called vaporware, which is announcements of software that you then don't deliver on, and you only make the announcement to frighten off your competitors.
Right. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to propose one possible predictor when I set up the question of, are there any personality traits? Are you at all familiar with the work of Frank Soloway?
Yes, I do know Frank's work, and I know Frank.
Okay,
yeah.
So let me summarize it, not so much for you, but for our viewers, and then I'd love to get your take because I'm going to exactly link it to innovation. So Frank Soloway basically flipped the birth order argument 180 degrees. Usually the literature and psychology on birth order argues that to the extent that there are birth order effects, meaning that you treat each of your children differently, then it is driven by the differential response of the parent towards the child. So I, as a parent, will treat my firstborn differently than my secondborn, differently from my third, and that's what then results in the downstream effect of their differences in personality traits and so on. Frank turned that upside down and said, no. There's actually an evolutionary mechanism that's happening here. Each child has to solve an evolutionarily important problem, which is how do I maximize the investment, the attention that is lavished upon me by my parents. Therefore, right. I'm going to try to occupy, it's actually a marketing problem, I'm going to try to occupy a unique niche in my parents' eyes. So when the first child is born, all of the niches are unoccupied. So meaning one niche might be, I'm going to be a good boy. Another niche might be, I'm going to be the rebellious, you know, tough guy, and so on. So when the first child is born, he's got all possible niches available to him. As you go down the SIP ship, there are fewer and fewer niches available because they've been taken by other siblings, right? Therefore, that pressure as you go down the birth order causes the later borns to be more malleable, more open to experiences and so on, because they have to solve this fundamental original developmental problem that the firstborns did not have to face.
Right.
So then he tests that, and I'm going to come to the innovation story in a second. He tests that in several ways. First, he looks at differences along the big five personality traits, and he shows that, for example, on the openness to new experiences and new ideas, later borns score higher than firstborns. Then he takes scientific innovations, which is the premise of his book, Born to Rebel, which I highly recommend for everybody to read, 1996 book, where he looks at the 28 most radical innovations. So this is exactly related to your book. And he shows that for 23 out of the 28 most radical scientific innovations in the history of human thought, it was the later born, the last born, who espouse the theory, and usually the most prominent vociferously anti that innovation was a firstborn. And actually, I took this idea and applied it to the acceptance of product innovation, and we replicated the effect. Later borns were more likely to be product innovators than firstborns and so on. What do you think of this whole story?
Well, I think it's interesting, but I'm fairly sure I've read that the pattern doesn't hold up as well as one would like. Yeah. You know, that actually you can come across examples of firstborns who were pretty rebellious and so on. So I certainly think that the point about finding your own niche in a large family is key, and that there is a degree of differentiation that, you know, you tend to move apart from the personality of your other siblings in order to distinguish yourself and find your own space. And I'm fairly sure that Judith Rich Harris has also written about that in her work, where, you know, her point is that if you took two identical twins and brought them up in separate families, they would end up being more similar than if you brought them up in the same family, where these two identical twins are going to sort of say, yeah, you're the quiet one, I'll be the loud one, or vice versa.
That's the nurture assumption, right? Is that the book?
I think that's in the nurture assumption. Yeah, beautiful book, really important book.
Yeah.
So, but it's undoubtedly true that you have to be a bit rebellious to be an innovator. I mean, that part I completely accept. You know, it's not going to be the conservative types who want things to stay the same who do new things. You know, kind of obviously.
Yeah. That makes sense.
But I do think, you see, in my book, I'm telling the stories of individuals because people like reading stories, but then I'm trying to get away from the emphasis on the individual. And I'm saying, look, see this person in context. Look at how much reliant they were on interactions with other people, how it couldn't have happened without other people. And so the problem with a lot of innovations in terms of psychology is that if you zoom in on the personality of Thomas Edison or something, you're not taking into account the fact that he was part of an enormous team, and some of the people in the team might not have been like that.
Right.
So yeah, I think there's something there, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much.
Last question, and then we'll wrap it up. Not related to your book. Maybe it is related to your book. What are your views? We'd be remiss in not mentioning this, given the reality we're facing. I know you are, I think your term was a lockdown skeptic, and I think I am part of your camp. Maybe give us a summary of that position for those who may not be lockdown skeptics.
Well, I think we were right to be worried about this virus when it first came along. It is a serious threat. I said so from the start. We needed to take some pretty drastic action. We needed to ban large gatherings. We needed to stop people shaking hands. We needed people to keep distance, etc. And we had to do some coercion to achieve that. We couldn't have done that just with voluntary measures. But it then became clear that the vast majority of deaths were happening in countries that had allowed the virus to get into the healthcare system, the health and social care system. And it was effectively a nosocomial infection, that is to say, something spread within hospitals. And that's become more and more clear in recent weeks, that the vast majority of these deaths are among vulnerable people who are in hospital or going to hospitals anyway, and who are then picking it up from healthcare workers because there is a lot of asymptomatic transmission. And once we realized that, we should have realized that we're getting this wrong. We're actually being far too permissive about what happens in hospitals and healthcare and care homes. We're allowing hospitals to send sick people back to care homes where they're starting new infections and things like that. So we're being far too permissive there, but we're being far too restrictive in everyday life. We're telling everyone to stay at home. Well, the one thing we know about the virus is that it doesn't spread very well in the open air. It spreads indoors. We're telling everyone to stop their economic activity. Well, that's going to cause other problems. It's going to cause mental health problems. It's going to cause problems of poverty and unemployment. And it's going to cause people not to get treatment for other illnesses. So locking people down at home seems to me to have added very little to what we needed to do, which was test, track, trace, stop large gatherings, stop shaking hands, all that kind of stuff. That, you know, that's what we should have focused on rather than locking people down at home.
I buy it. Hey, Matt, stay on the line when we get off, but thank you so much for coming. The hour flew by as I would have expected it to fly by. You're such an interesting guy. Thanks again for coming on, and best of luck with the book. I hope that it achieves all the successes that you wish it to achieve.
Gad, I really enjoyed talking to you again, and thanks very much for having me.
My pleasure. Let me just...